So then the next principle being brought out is that of gentle speech. Created beings must be instructed in what concerns their welfare without giving them pain. Sweet and gentle speech must be used by a teacher who desires to abide by the sacred law. He, forsooth, whose speech and thoughts are pure and ever perfectly guarded, gains the whole reward which is conferred by the Vedas. Let him not, even though in pain, speak words cutting others to the quick. Let him not injure others in thought or deed. Let him not utter speeches which make others afraid of him, since that will prevent him from gaining heaven. Okay, so that's section. So in other words, the teacher must deal. This is for everybody, but here specifically it's being mentioned with regard to the teacher. That when they're instructing the students, then they must use gentle speech. You know, pleasant, gentle speech. And then that's proper. So that's the actual way to deal with the teacher. Now just like you have the 10 offenses to the holy name, it's an offense to blaspheme the devotees of the Lord. That's what you should avoid. What's actually trying to be taught is you should appreciate and glorify the devotees. You understand? So the two go together. Much of the time we just look at it the one way. So here it'll say, see, the teacher should talk gentle speech. But what goes with this is he should only accept students that by speaking gently with, they'll appreciate and understand. Those who you have to use harsh speech, or those who speak harshly back, or this and that. So what happens is the teacher can be rough, then students are disturbed. That goes on for some, you know, generations because they're the seniors. Then at one point they just get sick of it and they stand up and revolt. And now it becomes a standard. Students can say whatever they want to the teacher because it's their right. They are so individuals. They can speak up. They can see. But then the principle of respect for the teacher is lost. So in other words, they haven't changed anything. All it is from the teacher being not as cultured as you should be, and the students then maintaining culture. Now the students become uncultured, and then the teacher, you know, should accept that. You know, now he should become more humble. But both of them are bad, right? Like that. But of the two, then even if the teacher is rough, if the student behaves properly, the student will develop, even though the teacher may not. But if the student is rough, then according to the previous point, is the teacher shouldn't even teach that person. So there's no question of the student advancing. Or even if he does teach him, then both the teacher and the student will not advance. Like that. They will both suffer. So the environment of knowledge has to be respect. And we see is because in Krishna consciousness, everything must be done with knowledge. Right? Then that means all the time the etiquette must be applied. Right? So therefore there must always be respect. So the point is that the gentle speech then, through gentle speech, then it establishes the proper environment for exchange between, you know, for exchange of knowledge between teacher and student. And it brings out the finer qualities of appreciation and respect. Does that make sense? He's a teacher, is respecting, here's a good student who wants to learn, they're sincere, so I should do. And the student is respecting that the teacher is someone who knows and can give that knowledge. So that appreciation and respect, that's the environment in which knowledge functions. No other environment. There's not another environment that it functions in. You know, otherwise, then it's like Karna's knowledge. You know, he learns so much from Parasarama, but when he actually needs it, he couldn't use it. Because the atmosphere wasn't right. But, you know, he was deceitful. Like that.
So we see here
knowledge can only be given to those who are proper. So you should protect knowledge. Then you should be respectful towards those who give you knowledge, whatever it is, material or spiritual. Right? Then of all those who are giving knowledge, the teacher is the most venerable. Between all means, in other words, those who are giving knowledge, who are benefiting us, that's the parental rasa. Right? Because parental rasa means that they give you what they feel is the best in their experience. Right? That's the natural thing. A parent always gives the best to the children. Right? Isn't it? Like that. They're always concerned. So, of those, then the teacher is the best. You know, means who's giving transcendental knowledge. Because then, that teacher then, it's that knowledge is eternal. Then of those who to discriminate within the gurus, you know, who's more venerable, then it gives the all the different aspects. You know, seniority of the Brahmins is knowledge, that of Kshatriyas from valor, that of Vaishyas from wealth and grain and other goods, and that of Shudras alone from age. Right? Because a Shudra, he does an art. And the more you do the art, the better you become. So the older the artisan, the better he is. So naturally, age becomes the element of respect. While Vaishyas, if he's clever, then he can make do business. You know? And by doing business, then who has more wealth means he's the more clever one, so he's to be more respected. You know? And then Kshatriyas of valor, therefore who's powerful, who commands respect. You know, by his deeds and by his, you know, just his own personality. Then they become prominent. And then Brahmins is sacred knowledge. Because that, by effort there, by realization, by, you know, then it just becomes very prominent. So age is not a consideration. Because someone at a young age may gain so much, and someone at an older age doesn't. You know, you can't always tell. You know, it's like that. It's just like, so let's say someone has been doing this for many lifetimes, so at a very young age, and they are very outstanding. And I think you probably mentioned that. Like, it was about, I had heard, they had mentioned that Ravi Shankar. You know, that he's been doing this for 1,000 lifetimes. Therefore, he's so prominent, you know, easily prominent, you know, in music. It's just because there's so many sitar players. I mean, there's tons of sitar players. But why he's the prominent one? In any circle in India or in the West, you mention his name, everybody knows him. You know? That's because he's just been dealing with it so long. So that element is always there, you know, in any of these. But so in the Brahminical field, with the knowledge, and it has so much. You know. Because the knowledge is, you could study one verse and have realization on it, and that you may have more knowledge than the next person. While business, even though you may be at a younger age and quicker and able to understand how to make it, still it's going to take you a little time. You know? But it may not take that much time. You know, valor also is a matter of a mood. So if you have that mood, then like that. And then art, that just takes time. That's just mechanical practice, day in, day out. You know, it's just like, what is it? Said in music, then. If I don't practice for one day, I'll notice the difference. If I don't practice for 2 days, everyone will notice the difference. Right? So it's just like that. If they're not out there with their hammer and chisel, you know, working on their stone or their wood or whatever it is that they're working on, then it'll be noticed. Like Ali Akbar, he is the son of Ravi Shankar's guru. Like that. So they were students together. Ali Akbar knew more than what Ravi Shankar knew. Ali Akbar knew 50% of what his father knew. Well, said Ravi Shankar knew 25%. But even though when he was young, Ali Akbar was much more considered, much more superior musician. So what he knows, what he can do is more. But he gets criticized because he doesn't practice. So even though he can do amazing things, since he doesn't practice, therefore, then sometimes when he presents it, it doesn't come out as perfectly as it could. Or if his Ravi Shankar practices, whatever he does comes out right. No, it may not be as inspired as what Ali Akbar relates. You know? So he's good. So now, so people say, you know, the connoisseurs in the music field say, if you want to hear, you know, good music of Ali Akbar, listen to his old tapes. Don't listen to the new tapes. So new tapes, it's not exactly inspiring. Is by his inspiration, it's good, but that's nice. You know, when he thinks up, it's great. But his ability to present it isn't as good as it was if you go back, you know, 15, 20 years.
Ali Akbar.
Yeah, no, he was. I mean, these top musicians, like that North Indian musicians, 10, 12, 14 hours a day they practice. Like that. South Indians, they do 6 hours. Somehow or another, they all together. But you know, the North, they do like that 12, 14. You know, so this top guy, that's all they do, I guess. You know, that's why they're able to do this stuff they can do. Because the South is not so much on playing incredibly fast things. Well, the North that's developed, South will do it for a short time, but they won't do it as long. So it's not as important. So therefore, 6 hours a day is enough to maintain a professional standard. But the North, because they have to play at these incredible speeds, because they're playing for the audience. You know, South is the things that's Brahmins and they're playing for, you know, music and science and like that. So they don't have to be, they don't have to do so many tricks. The North, and they use so much more tricks. Good, you know, good tricks, but I'm just saying, those tricks take a lot of practice. So that's why then Shudras, then it goes by age alone. Because if he's actually a good Shudra, he is practicing, constantly practicing his art, so the older he is, the better he is. You know, like that. So that's why age then is so important. Age is there for everybody, but it's for Shudras, it is the point, right? Because sacred learning is not an important thing for them. You know, maybe they may have their philosophy, like, you know, Salvat or Dali or something. That's not the main thing. They're known for their art. You know, Dali has his philosophy, great, but they're only listening to it because he's got good paintings. You know, Picasso or what's his name? Michelangelo, they may have the philosophy, it's great. You know, the philosopher artist. But people are only listening to the philosophy because of their art. If they weren't artists, no one would listen to their philosophy. You understand? So because that's the point, because amongst artists, it's their art. So the older you are, generally the better your art is. Does that make sense? Like that. So that's the... And then here, then the gentle speech. So then the whole culture between student and student and teacher then is gentle. That's why the respectful attitude already has to be there. If that's there, then the teacher can use gentle speech. If it's not there, then they don't accept such disciples. So that's the thing previously, is they would only accept those who are qualified. They wouldn't go out and accept those who are not. You know? So in Kali Yuga, then people are not as qualified, so then, you know, more tolerance is necessary. You know? But as far as technical knowledge goes, then that's a whole other thing. If you're not gentle, you can't really learn. Because if you're not gentle, you'd be rough. If you're rough, you can't focus. So then we see then to do that, then you need equanimity of mind. That's the next. Brahma should always fear homage as if it were poison, and constantly desire to suffer scorn as though he would long for nectar. For he who is scorned nevertheless may sleep with an easy mind. Awake with an easy mind. With an easy mind, walk here and there among men. But the scorner utterly perishes. Right? So you don't have to worry about, they said this, we've got to get them back. No, you don't have to. You just go on to your service. And because the person said it, they will perish. That's the point. Because when you scorn somebody, you take on their karma. So actually, the person who's been scorned has been benefited. So therefore, he can sleep with an easy mind. He's just been relieved of more karma. His ego may be able to handle it or not, but that's why I want you to be humble and tolerant and not expect respect. Then people can say whatever they like, and if they criticize, it's to your benefit, because then they take all your bad qualities. Right? So then they benefited you. Therefore, then you feel kind towards them. You hope for their welfare. Then that will make them advance also.
They take the karma because they
have criticized. Whatever you criticize for. I mean, it's a typical scenario is that you have one person or a group of persons criticizing another person or group of persons about a quality or an activity. And you see with time, they do the same thing. Isn't that typical?
Yeah.
Why is it typical? It's typical because the persons who criticize take on the karma of those persons in that area. So they take on that quality. That's why it's just typical that those who criticize after a while become like those who they criticize. One, it's in their consciousness. But it becomes in their consciousness, becomes fixed in the consciousness because they take the karma of that, that creates that. Let's say the person acts in a particular way because of a particular mentality. So when you criticize them for that, then you take that quality yourself. You know, and you take those reactions. You take the reactions that cause that quality. Right? Does that make some sense?
Yeah.
So the other person is actually purified. So those persons who are highly critical of everyone, and they're doing great welfare work for all these people that they're criticizing. Of course, they don't do themselves much good, but they do the others. But now that's also, if you are like this, sleep with an easy mind. If you react and then start to criticize back, then you take their qualities. So then neither is benefited. If you do like this, is they criticize you, and you don't react, and it's fine with you, then you're benefited, they're not benefited. And, or if you go to the next level where they may criticize, you don't react, but you are become their well-wisher, then both are benefited. Mm-hmm. Like that. So that's the three alternatives you have in dealing with the critical attitude. Because by homage you may become proud. By proud, then he becomes less tolerant. Right? Humility creates tolerance. Right? Pride creates intolerance.
He said that if one listens, critics in his name from others, so it's better to leave that place.
Mm-hmm.
Because mind becomes contaminated.
Mm-hmm.
So what you said, it seems like it's about a very much qualified person who can, who does not accept it, his own, doesn't touch by this. So what about, this situation, those who are not in such a way? In a situation when, externally, one does not respond to such criticism, but in the mind he feels, he has some kind of...
So to that degree he's going to be caught up in it.
Mm-hmm.
In that degree if he's not, then he won't be.
One becomes frustrated or something.
To that degree that you're caught up in it, then you'll be affected by it.
Mm-hmm.
It's that simple. It's just like if I say... You say, well, you're saying if you don't put your hand in the water, then you won't get wet. But if you put your hand a little bit in the water, then what happens? You get a little wet. You know, you put your whole arm in, then your whole arm's wet. If you jump in, then you're fully wet. So it's just how much you are involved, that much you'll be affected. So then you try to be as minimally involved as possible. Understanding that the goal is to be not involved at all. You know, so from wherever point you are, then that should be practiced. You know, you may react strongly and then figure, oh no, no, and then relax, and then after a while you don't react strongly, but in the heart still something's there, and then you get rid of that. And then it comes to the point where it doesn't bother you. Yeah? Study of the Veda is the highest austerity. 4.6. So now this is pointing out that there, by austerity, the whole culture, the whole varnashram system, everything that you want on the spiritual and material platform is established through austerity. Like that. So then here it's pointing out, of austerity, then the highest is study of the Veda. A twice-born man who has been sanctified by the employment of the means described above in due order shall gradually and cumulatively perform the various austerities prescribed for those who study the Veda. So it means all these things that have been described before, you know, equanimity of mind, the respect of authority, the celibacy, all these different things. Let a Brahmin who desires to perform austerities constantly repeat the Veda. For the study of the Veda is declared to be in this world the highest austerity for a Brahmana. A twice-born man who, not having studied the Veda, applies himself to other and worldly study, soon falls, even while living, to the condition of a Shudra and his descendants after him. So, in other words, that for the twice-born, then if they want to study something, then the first thing that should be studied is the scriptures. After studying the scriptures, then they can apply themselves to other branches of knowledge to expand that. Because the Veda includes all subjects, but it means the Veda itself, it means for us, means, you know, our essential scriptures. Veda here means knowledge. So depending upon what is your particular lineage, then Veda will have its particular definition. Right? In general, it simply means study of the Vedic literatures, you know, of that specifically, the Veda itself. Like that. And then other branches you can study. Like that. But then, like for us, that means, you know, Bhagavad Gita, Srimad Bhagavatam, Chaitanya Charitamrita, Nectar Devotion, like this. Applying oneself to that, those have been studied nicely. Then after that, if you want to expand into other branches and other areas, then that can be, you know, fine. And then after that, you know, last means you're worldly. That's why it's recommended that before one graduates, one studies whatever he can, you know, what he needs. Then he can continue his study as a householder. But as a householder, it means so much time must be given for one's particular occupation. So then that may require studies on the mundane platform. So that should be done after. You know. So the essential things must be already gotten. And then you can continue whatever you like later. Does that make any sense? You know, just like for the Brahmins, the first thing that they study is the scriptures. Then after that, they'll learn arts and anything else they want to learn. But it's always, the thrust is always on the main, the philosophy, the learning the mantras, learning the culture and the etiquette, you know, learning the technicalities of the puja and, you know, other aspects, you know, astrology, all these things. Whatever's going to be used in their body of knowledge they're functioning with, or used with their occupation, like that. You know. Then after that, they can learn other things. Then it's that. Otherwise, let's say if he just learns music, then unless he's studying along with it all the Veda and everything else, then he's known as a musician. Like we read before, Ravi Shankar, he's known as a musician. They're Brahmins. Shankar is a Brahmin, Varanasi Brahmins. Right? But they're only known as musicians, him and his brother. Right? Uday Shankar is a dancer. You know? That's how he was famous in the West. So that's how his brother got in on that kind of, like, you know, connection. And then he started playing music. So then he became famous. But he's known as a musician, he's not known as a Brahmin. I'm sure most devotees wouldn't know that he's a Brahmin. Because he just plays music. You know, maybe in his own personal life he follows a few things here and there, but he's not known for that. While while Narad Muni is also known as being a musician, but he's known as a Brahman, and a preacher, an acharya, an authority, and he's expert in music. You see all of Shiva's expert in music, Brahma's expert in music, Indra, everyone, Madhvacharya. Madhvacharya didn't sleep at night. You know, everyone else is asleep, he would just play Veena the whole night. You know? So like that, then, you know, things would work. So Hanuman's expert musician. But you don't think of him as a musician. You don't think of Madhva as a musician. Prabhupada was an expert musician, but you don't think of him as a musician. So that's the point, is that the music, the arts, the worldly studies, those are secondary. The primary then is the philosophy. Philosophy and the devotional scriptures and that. So that's the point. So that is the highest austerity. So rather than other austerities, then let a Brahmin study. If he wants to be austere, let him study. You know, he has extra time, you know, you want to do something austere, do that. That's more important. Right? You know, not eating the six tastes during Chaturmas, you get a nice voice. Or, you know, these different things like that. Or you get a body that doesn't smell. And eating the six tastes, I think you get that. That's there. But studying the scriptures then gives you transcendental results. So if you want to be austere, okay, then rather than, you know, doing something else, study for 6 hours or whatever it is. That's austere. Fasting, you can walk around, you can do anything else, you can distract your mind. But study, it's just you and the books. It's not something else to distract your mind. You know what I'm saying? So, and that austere, you get the best benefit because you get knowledge and you have things that you can give others. Does that make sense? Yeah. So that's why it's considered the best. So therefore, since the whole Varnashram system is based on austerity and perfection of the performance of your duties is based on austerity, the best of all austerity is studying scripture. Does that make sense? So by studying scripture, then you can actually perfect your spiritual and material activities. Because something is perfected through austerity. So by studying the scriptures, then with that you get knowledge from that, then you'll be able to properly perform your duties with the right attitude. Does that make sense? So we can see, that's what Prabhupada was putting so much emphasis on reading his books. That's the austerity of the Brahmins. Chanting 16 rounds, following four good principles, studying the books, you know, preaching. This is the real austerity. This is the top, highest austerity. So what Prabhupada gave was the highest. You know, sometimes Prabhupada gave simple and someone else is going to give something more developed, more detailed, more complex, more high. No. What Prabhupada has given is so high that those who don't know the field that well, or not masters of the field, don't see what Prabhupada's given. That's the point. And those that really know the field know that what Prabhupada did is very special. You know, taking the highest and made it available to the lowest. That's a kshatriya. That's the definition of a kshatriya. One who can make the esoteric aspects of the scriptures perceivable by the senses to the person that they're telling it to. So that's special. Okay, so then all these duties, right? So it says, and who has been sanctified by the above means, shall then perform the various austerities prescribed for those who study the Veda. Okay. So then we see here is that who's been sanctified by the means. In other words, he's performing activity with knowledge. So where does he get the knowledge from? Then it's based on hearing. So from Shravana, the first level of study, where you hear. Then comes manana, which means contemplation and practice. Right? But we see the foundation is still shabda, is still the scripture. Then you apply it in your life. Then you see it. Then you realize it. Right? Then you become shastra chakshu. Does that make sense?
Yeah.
But contemplating in combination with performing it. If you just hear about it and only contemplate but don't do it, then you don't get the realization. So you contemplate and apply it, and then contemplate again. Well, how does it apply here? How does it there? You know, you try to get it where it works. Does that make sense?
Yeah.
So you can only get it to work if you do it. Just like I can tell you in a few seconds how to ride a bicycle. Right? It means basically you put your feet on the pedals and on the seat, and with balance, you know, by the handlebars and by the leaning of your weight, then you can move around anywhere you want. Sounds pretty easy. Right? So that's the point. So you have people sitting around and philosophizing about riding of a bicycle. But they themselves, they don't know how to ride, they don't really know what they're talking about. They may know lots of nice technical points. They don't really know because they've contemplated, but they haven't practiced. So that's all the farther they get. So what they get to know is a little bit more and more understanding. They never have realization. Realization only comes with practice. Knowledge with practice gives realization. Knowledge without practice just gives deepening of knowledge. Right? Therefore, Prabhupada says the armchair speculators. That means that they never do it. They just sit around and talk about it. Okay. So that's this. Okay, now we go back to topic 3 about those activities. Duties of brahmacharya. Because everything that's been here up to now applies to anyone. Anyone who wants to study the scriptures and follow the Vedic culture has to follow all those. It doesn't matter what barn or ashram, these matter. Right? Respect, you know, giving in knowledge. Just even if you have an art, you don't give your art to somebody who is not going to appreciate it. You know, so all this applies to everybody. So now it'll go back specifically for brahmacharya today. Duties of brahmacharya. The student who has been initiated must be instructed in the performance of the vows and gradually learn the Veda, observing the prescribed rules. Okay, so now, vows, in other words, the culture and the character is the first thing that is taught. Then, as his character develops, then to that degree, he can start being taught the Veda. Because someone without character, you cannot teach them. Say what you like, you cannot teach them. Because the point is even if they're intelligent, they'll be proud. And so they won't be able to understand the fine points that you're making. And they're too proud to understand that they can't understand. So therefore, since they can't understand it, they'll take it that you're wrong. So therefore, you don't waste your time with such people. So character has to be taught first. And when character starts to develop, to that degree it develops, to that degree you can teach knowledge. This makes some sense. That's why it goes in this order. Then he should learn the Veda, observing the prescribed rules. So he must perform the culture, and following the rules of the culture, then he can study. Because absorption of knowledge depends upon character. Mm-hmm. Means if you have a desire to learn, only then you'll ask questions. And these questions are only fully actually be answered if you apply them in seva. And by service, then that again creates the desire to learn more, because now it's deepened your understanding, you've gotten realization from it, so you want to know more. So therefore inquiry then rises. And then from inquiry means your interest to learn, from that comes inquiry. Right? Because if you want to learn, you only learn if you inquire. If you don't inquire, you can't learn. It's just the way it works. Does that make sense?
In your service, will be like that? Not just service in relationship to knowledge you've
Well, specifically, if you have a specific knowledge, then it that is means. In other words, the technical skill of the knowledge will only be fully understood by practicing it. But the principles that it works on, then any service will create. It means if you're contemplating it, then you can do any service and you get result, because service is a general principle. Right? And the principles that any body of knowledge are based on is also common. Is that making sense? But the specific skill, unless you do it, you know, won't happen. Because everything's connected to the philosophy, therefore any service will give realization in the philosophy. But if you're studying, let's say, Ayurveda, then unless you practice Ayurveda, you won't get the realization in it. But there is philosophy in Ayurveda. That you may get through any kind of service. Understanding how the philosophy, how Ayurveda connects to the transcendental subject matter, what the principles it's based on, how that works and all this. So that's you can get from doing anything, washing pots, any practical service that is done in pleasing Krishna. But if you want to get realization on the workings of the Ayurveda itself technically, then you need to practice Ayurveda. You know what I'm saying? But the principles on which it works, that any service will give you. Yeah. Does that make sense?
Yeah. And service requires humility.
Yes. That's why the brahmacharis beg. It keeps them humble. Then they're able to serve nicely. Because unless menial service is there is no progress. The student doesn't progress. Because if there's no menial service, his character doesn't develop. So how will it be prosperous? It may appear in the short run to work, in the long run it doesn't. You know? Like that. Because if you're not cultivated from the beginning, then when the children hit teenage, then the character is not good, then they do all kinds of crazy stuff. They waste so much time. You may say, oh, they're studying, but they could do so much more. You know? They could do so much more. So only if they have a very materialistic drive that they want to get some perfection in the knowledge so that they can get therefore some particular material facility. They may have the drive to go for it. There's a small percentage that have that drive that will take them through adolescence. But that's because they have another purpose. So you'll see is they are actually then have character because they'll be self-controlled. Everyone else is out playing. They're not. They're studying. You know, like that. Everyone else is cheating. They're not. That so still its character is there. So unless they've imbibed that when they're younger, they're not going to have it when they're older. And that comes by a service and association. So that's why the Vedas put so much emphasis on the service attitude and developing the character. Because if those are there, everything else will come. And if those aren't there, nothing else will come. They may get knowledge, but what's the use of it?
Prabhupada said he wanted to develop a first class in human beings. But now he's really gone deep into that.
Means those who know Brahman. So, and those who can explain it to others. Because of all the austerity, studying the scriptures is the best. Of all charity, giving knowledge of the scriptures is the best. So, you know. So that's that first class man. He's talking about those who are well read in the scriptures and know how to give it, have the interest to and can give it to others. So that's it. If you have that class of man, you can develop all the others. The Kshatriyas come from Brahmins. So therefore, you cannot have a Kshatriya if you don't have Brahmins. There's no Brahmins, you actually don't have Kshatriyas. Right? Brahmins be Brahmins on their own, but you won't have the whole society for them to function in unless they're Kshatriyas. So it's natural that they all go together. You know, if he just wants to live in the forest, you don't need Vaishyas. You know, but if they're going to move, you know, in the society, you know, the urban society or the rural society, then you have to have Vaishyas. You know, if they're just going to go to the forest, that's another thing. you know, and for everybody else to work, then you need shudras. But it all starts with Brahmins. You create Brahmins, you've created the society. Because the Brahmins will then create the rest. Yeah? You understand? Like Chanakya. Chanakya, he was running his ashram. It's not functioning because so much things going wrong because he's a bad king. He even personally gets insulted by the bad king. So he decides he's going to remove this king, not only the king, but his whole dynasty. Because he's bad, then all his family will be bad. So it took him 8 years, but he went to the trouble, and he installed Chandragupta. So therefore, he as a Brahmin created a king. Then with that king, then the whole society functions. Then he can perform his Brahminical duties very peacefully. Does that make some sense?
Yeah. But a student who resides with his teacher must observe the following restrictive rules, duly controlling all his organs in order to increase his spiritual merit. So in other words, following the rules and performing the activities, controlling the senses, right? And as previously mentioned, with knowledge, that will get you resolved. You know? And if you want to go back to Godhead, then you add into it that you do it for Krishna, it's devotion. But in any case, you want to move forward, then you have to do this. Okay, so then here's many things. So that's that we see is the principle there, is that the duties, then the fundamental point is performing activities authorized by the Lord with controlled senses. Then a brahmacharya will get his result. Anybody will get a result because all the orders are based on brahmacharya. Without brahmacharya, you don't have grihastha vanaprastha nyas. Without brahmacharya, you don't have brahmacharya vaishya. There's no brahmacharya, you only have shudra. And even then, shudra has pretty good qualities. You might not even get shudras. So daily worship. Every day, having bathed and being purified, he must worship the deities and place fuel in the sacred fire. In other words, worship the deity and perform sacrifice. So then for us, that means, you know, something in connection with the preaching. So the deities are worshipped and the preaching is there. So the Pancharatrika and the Bhagavat both are covered. Let him abstain from meat, perfumes, women, and from doing injury to living creatures, from sensual desire, anger, covetousness, from gambling, idle disputes, backbiting, and lying. Right? So all these things, all these will just increase, will distract him, you know, and create impurity within his heart. So he won't actually be able to focus. Like that. Otherwise he'll just get distracted. Menial service and begging. Let him fetch a pot full of water, flowers, cow dung, earth, and kusa grass, as much as may be required by his teacher, and daily go to beg food. In other words, any whatever paraphernalia facility the teacher needs, that he provides, and he begs food. So this is why previously the gurukuls were, how do you say? There was no charge. Because whatever was needed, they would just go collect here from the forest, and beg the rest. Like that. So it both was beneficial to the ashram because everything they begged and everything or collected all went for use in the ashram. Like that. You know, so if they begged food, they begged the food that they eat. At the same time, it creates the service attitude of humility. Yeah. So that's the function. Both when ordered by his teacher and without a special command, a student shall always exert himself in studying the Veda and in doing what is serviceable to his teacher. And so therefore he must be austere and perform menial service. So if means when the teacher says study, he should do it, and when he doesn't, he has free time, then he should sit down and study. If he does both of these, then he'll advance nicely. And in doing what is serviceable. If he applies himself to rendering service, then that study will bear fruit. Right? Does that make sense? In the presence of his teacher, let him always eat less, wear a less valuable dress and ornaments than the former, and let him rise earlier from his bed and go to rest later. In other words, he never tries to do anything that's better than the guru. And that. So this is how he should try to function. He should never try to outdo. Like that. Does that make sense? Otherwise it develops, it becomes ostentatious. You know? And this will also then develop the proper mood of service. Service and humility will come. So you see, it's always going back to the same principles of service, humility, and study. You know, austerity is a study. He must have respect for the teacher, so he must be humble. And he must have a service attitude. So these are in place, it functions. As the Prabhupada says, humble, submissive, service attitude. That will be a success. You have that, you go back to Godhead. You don't have that, you won't get back to Godhead. Let him not pronounce the mere name of his teacher without adding an honorific title, behind his back even, and let him not mimic his gait, speech, and deportment. Right? So he said, the teacher has to be respected, because if he's respected, then what he gives will be valued. But if you respect somebody, then what they give you, then it's very important for you. If you don't respect them, who cares? Right? Isn't it? That's the thing.
It's the culture, it's the etiquette, which is the character, which allows everything else to function.
Yeah. If there's no character, there is no culture. There is no development. There is none of this happens. You know, so even if he's just hanging around with the other boys, he doesn't just refer to the teacher by some, you know, appropriate, you know, way. Yeah, whatever it is, it has to be something that means something. You know, I don't say, hey, teach. You know, like that. And they shouldn't mimic how he walks. You know, his mood, how he speaks, like that. They shouldn't just, you know, goof on that. You know, that will not be progressive.
Imitate
means like how he walks and you walk like him. You know, like that kind of thing is a joking.
That's,
means you don't goof on the teacher.
Oh.
Like that. By association, you maybe pick up some of those habits and movements and that, but that's natural. That's how you're behaving now.
Mm-hmm.
That doesn't mean for fun, you know, the teacher has some kind of funny walk, and so the student's likely to walk in that funny way. That means lack of respect, you know. Like Lord Chaitanya, that there was one. Bhakti Chumar has told this story. I'm not sure if it's Chaitanya Bhagavat or Chaitanya Mangal. When he was a kid, he was like 3 years old, you know, and he was the, you know, ringleader of all the kids of that age, you know. You know, ringleader being, you know, operative term. You know? So then this big pandit came to town. He was a Mayavadi. Big pandit, you know, elderly, you know, famous, well-respected. Came to Navadvipa, because Navadvipa is the center of learning. And so then, when he came in with all his disciples and that, you know, so his whole, you know, like that, his gait, his speech, his deportment and all that, he walks in. So as he walks by, the Lord Chaitanya, you know, gets together all his playmates, and they all take their claws and tie them on their heads, you know, like you know, because the pundits would always wear a big turban and like that, and then they would strut around and, you know, walk behind him so he could see them, you know, and he'd get really upset. But, you know, what can you say about 3-year-olds, you know, if it's teenagers or others in Gachasa, the 3-year-olds, what do you say? You know, so he was very unimpressed with this, you know. You know, and I'm not sure Jagannath Misra didn't come and, you know, apologize for his behavior as a kid, but whatever it is. So then, later, I'm not sure, you know, that day, next day, whatever it is, but sometime later, then the man was, you know, either staying in somebody's house or been invited for bhiksha at somebody's house. And then Lord Chaitanya came, right?
And you know, little kids like that, they don't wear anything, right? So that's why, you know, maybe I'll caught the tiger on his head. But they just, you know, walk around naked. So then the man was eating, or sat down to eat. You know, he must have been saying his prayers and all that. When he saw Lord Chaitanya, you know, coming, you know, towards me, kind of like lowered his head and looked like he was really paying attention to his food, you know. And then, you know, the next thing the guy knows is he just sees 2 feet standing in front of his face, you know, but he's not looking up because he doesn't want to make eye contact. And he sees this stream of water coming down onto his plate. And it's kind of like, what's this? So he looks up and he sees Lord Chaitanya is passing urine on his plate. And then the guy's looking at him, how can you do that? Lord Chaitanya is very, very, you know, boldly says, I pass urine on the plate of, on the plate of the Maya bodies. You know, so he did tolerate Maya bodies at all. I'm not sure if the guy didn't contemplate this and then convert and actually become a devotee. But in any case, Lord Chaitanya, you can see Lord Chaitanya's mood towards Maya bodies, you know, he passed urine on your plate. But, I heard Bhakti Trumas tell this story. So that's the whole point, is that you only imitate their gait and all that if you're actually kind of like joking on them at their expense. So that should never be done.
If it's done out of devotion.
Well, how would you do it out of devotion? You're sitting with your friends. How would you, with devotion, get up and mimic? And
I mean, it's not in that sense, but like sometimes disciples of Srila Prabhupada used to, you know, speaking this, you know, funny, you know, English.
But that's just by association. That's what I'm saying. They're not mimicking. Mimic means to just, you know, it's like you're doing a drama. You mimic, you do it for fun. When you mimic somebody, you make fun of them. Okay? So, by association, if you pick up some of those qualities, and those are just the way you behave, you know, it's not you're doing it specifically to create some fun in amongst your friends. Okay? So there's a difference. Mimic means to, you know,
clown around.
Yeah.
Make fun.
Yeah, to make fun. That's what the word means. Is that okay?
Mm-hmm. What about for one's own prestige?
That you should be careful. You know? Because if you're doing it for your own prestige, then you've got caught up thinking that you are the doer and you have the quality, when it's just because the quality of the spiritual master. So that's the point, is by association you follow in the footsteps there. So if it matches, it's used, and if it doesn't, it's not. So the principle may be used, the detail may not be. Mm-hmm. Like Gorkhashordas Babaji Maharaj was on red. So that does, so following his footsteps doesn't mean that, no, we don't study either, because he was like, no. His disciple was the most educated, you know, person there was. So, but he was following the principle of always being absorbed in, you know, hearing and chanting the holy name and benefiting others by giving them, you know, useful instruction. Like that. So that's the thing. So if it comes, if it looks the same, fine. It's like Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati Thakur sat for, I think, 9 years and chanted. I forget how many crores. Mm-hmm.
One being.
Yeah, less than one. Maybe that was like 100 crore, I think. Because 10 million is a crore. But 10 times 100,000 is a billion, so it means 100 crores. So a lot of names. It's a lot of names.
So he could do that, is there, but it doesn't mean that he always did that. But the mood would be there. Like that.
Main point is here is that mimic, you know? Mimic, or like you're saying, just for your own aggrandizement, but one would avoid that. Wherever people justly censure or falsely defame his teacher, he must cover his ears or depart thence to another place. Even if they're censuring correctly, one shouldn't listen. Even if it's just, there is some problem. He has done something wrong, and somebody says something about that. Still, he shouldn't listen to that. Or falsely defames means what he's saying is wrong. In either case, he shouldn't be listened to. Because otherwise, sometimes, oh, if it's correct, it can be listened to. No, none of us listen to it. Okay. By censuring his teacher, though justly, he will become in his next birth an ass. Right? So even if he's right, just that he's done that to his teacher, that's why Arjuna was so careful that he wouldn't censure the teacher. He didn't want to fight with the teacher or this or that, or say that they were wrong. So you saw that even though that they were on the other side and they were fighting, the Pandavas always respected his gurus. You know, Bhishma and Drona, Kripa, they always respected him. You know, they didn't have much good to say about Duryodhana. They'd bump into him or Shakuni or Karna. Then you'd see that they'd say all kinds of stuff. But otherwise, they would always respect them. You know, before the battle, they would respect them. Even after they were killed, they would respect them. By falsely defaming, that's by justly censuring him, you become an ass. By falsely defaming him, a dog. Like that. He who lives on his teacher's subsistence will become a worm. In other words, he just lives off the teacher. He lives off but doesn't do any work. And he was envious of his merit, a large insect. Sometimes you see these big monster bugs, out of proportion bugs, these big monster bugs. So that comes from this, envious of his merit. Let him, So that's in relation to the teacher. Let him not perform for a wife of his teacher the offices of anointing her, assisting her during bath, shampooing her limbs, or arranging her hair. For women are able to lead astray in this world not only a fool but even a learned man, and make him a slave of desire and anger. One should not sit in a lonely place with one's mother, sister, or daughter, for the senses are powerful and master even a learned man. So this next section is be very, very careful about dealing with women. Means like that. So in any case, whether the wife is young or old, he won't do these offices for her. You know, anything that's personally dealing with her body. Like that. And if she's too young, he'll also be very careful about even touching her feet when he offers obeisances. You know, he'll be a little bit more careful. Like that. So this is the principle of the brahmachari has to be very, very careful. So this is for anybody. Right? It says with one's mother, sister, or daughter. Right? So daughter, that means you're grihastha. So you see within this there are rules that apply to everybody. Like that. You know, like before, he can't touch women. So here he doesn't touch women. Grihastha can touch women. But still he has to be careful about sitting alone. Okay, because otherwise they make him a slave of desire and anger. When being with the women, it invokes desire. When you can't fulfill that desire, then you get frustrated, you get angry. Yeah? Because whatever is there, either what the woman wants, it can't be fulfilled, or what you want to fulfill yourself from the woman can't be fulfilled. So, because they're there, desire comes up, either your own or them. Right? When man's with woman, he starts getting all kinds of desires. And when a woman has a man around, she gets all kinds of desires. So in any case, desire is the principle of the interaction. So fulfillment of that desire, but those desires can't be fulfilled to some degree, but never successfully, fully, or not regularly. Maybe today they're done, but tomorrow they're not. You know? So that's the thing, it's when the man-woman relationship is so unstable on these platforms of fulfilling the desire, because the emotions always are changing. Therefore, it creates frustration, which creates anger.
So you see, as desire and anger becomes the basis of the existence. So one has to be very, very careful. That's why there's always the control of the senses, the study of the shastras, like that. Then you reduce it to the minimum. Like that, reduce it to the minimum. Then it's workable. But if it's not, then it becomes unworkable. There's so much desire, it's frustrated, so much goes the other way. You know, you always think, I mean, that's what the whole thing of soap operas, right? And they're so popular because all they're dealing with is desire and anger. That's all.
Okay, and the last point in this is, as a man who digs with a spade into the ground obtains water, even so an obedient pupil obtains the knowledge which lies hidden in his teacher. In other words, so much is there in the teacher, it's not obvious what's there. So only by that humble, submissive service attitude, then whatever knowledge the teacher has, he'll get. And that degree that he has that mood, that to that degree he'll get. And then the last point of this whole like section on dealing with superiors. The teacher, the father, the mother, and an elder brother must not be treated with disrespect, especially by a Brahmin, though one be grievously offended by them. Right? So even if they offend, one shouldn't deal with them disrespectfully. Like you see, Arjuna and all, they would deal with the teachers respectfully, even though they were may or may not be behaving nicely. As a principle, Prahlad Maharaj always dealt with his father nicely, even though he was not dealing nicely with him. You know, you don't see Prahlad at any time raise his voice, use improper language. Right? Yeah. Make sense?
Very kind even to the son of the teacher.
Yeah. And because he was the son, that's why Arjuna would never fight with him fully, because he was the son of the teacher. Like that. That makes sense? Any other questions on this? Acquiring knowledge in times of distress.
That's funny. There is kind of Prabhupada in India, and then they got to know his sister, Krishna. She was sitting on the stage, and then he saw all the Matajis around his sister. And then he looked and he said, why are they all around her, you know? Well, because she's a sister prophet. Well, what did she do? She's just an old woman.
Yeah, they're sitting over there. They should be sitting over here. Yeah, what did she do?
Just an old woman.
That's funny. Yeah, she used to cook, probably eat. You know? I mean, she had to. No question of not eating when his sister cooked. She cooked with mustard oil, right? Taste is very good, unless you're used to it, it's very rough on the health. You know? And ghee is better taste, but whatever. So she'd always cook with mustard oil, which is always not so good for him. But if she cooked, he ate it, no question. Any other questions, or it's kind of dark, so I guess we're...
The point of criticism is always in the day, criticism and correcting someone.
Yes, but that's done, who it's appropriate for. Criticizing, then, is for someone who is... who it's your duty to correct. You know? So that means... You may be like a friend's... With juniors, you could use stronger language. But generally, equals or superiors, you wouldn't. You know, unless it's somehow or another been given as your duty, but then that's a specific detail. But then you can see, when it's followed up, is that it's very common that the criticism is there, and that it's for their good, and this and that, so many nice things. But other than those moments, they don't seem to care. They're not with them all the rest of the time. They're not there to thick and thin. Like Vidura was very strong with his elder brother, Dhritarashtra, but he was always there.
And he took him to the forest. He set him up. He got him into meditation. He taught him all that. You know, he got benefit. So he's willing to correct and to support. But to the guru, like this, then it's not. Because here is brother. So technically they're equal to these elder brothers, so they're not treated with disrespect. It's just, but here, then, one has to be very, very careful, to see that the two are balanced. Otherwise, it just, somebody comes in, you don't know, they don't know you, and then correcting, and then goes away. Then it's the etiquette's not so strong. It should be someone who's closer, who's known. All those different kinds of things. It slows things down, but in the long run, it's the culture that matters. Because devotees will be anybody, but devotees are in anxiety because of lack of culture. But that, it's not other things, it's lack of culture. So because it's expedient today, because somebody only has half an hour to get something done, but it's something that should actually take weeks to do, they can do their troubleshooting in that half an hour, and they solve a specific detail of the problem that is a problem today, whatever is the most acute aspect. But it won't get rid of the problem. And it'll only compound it, because then now you've gotten rid of one detail, but still the principle remains, and so again and again and again it will come up. And the end does not justify the means. That's a completely bogus concept. Is that the means must be authorized by Shastra, and they actually go through the means to get that in. Right? You know what I'm saying? It's like, it's said to be, say, okay, you establish something, you want to make peace by violence. But it's, unless it's authorized by the scriptures, then we don't see that in places where they've used violence to get peace, that they got peace. You know what I'm saying? The element that bothered them, they kicked out, and then it keeps on going that way. Because the method gets a result. You know what I'm saying? It's directly connected to. Like if you take something and put it in water, the result will be it gets wet. You take something and put it in fire, the result will be it gets hot. You can't say, well, yes, I'm going to stick it in the fire and make it very cool. It may sound good. It may sound excellent. But it's not that actually works. And it has to be authorized by the scriptures, because only the scripture knows how stuff works. So that's the thing. Others don't know, because seemingly it's one way and it's the opposite. Like, it's like you deal with electricity. The calculations for electricity, so many of the calculations reverse. The higher the voltage, and the lower the this thing, or the this and that. It doesn't make any sense, right? This doesn't make any sense. So unless you hear from authority, you would never know that that's how it works. So that's the whole principle, is that unless it's heard from authority, then it can't be successful. So the idea is that criticism for the thing, but unless the criticism actually has a practical solution, and there's follow-up, and it's personal, and it's for the person's welfare, and for them fitting into the society, and becoming a part of the society, and making it all happen, or if the person's so bad, to removing them from that, but then you have to have the power and the influence to do that, and it has to still be authorized. Like that. So then it's then you can do. But otherwise, to just say that's just flowery language. Flowery language of the what do you call it? New age flowery language. That's all. And where is the result? Right? Where is the result? If new age was the answer, your top government people, they would be talking like that, behaving like that, doing like that. They'd be doing it. You know what I'm saying? If Cubby was the thing, then the governments would be using it. You know what I'm saying? So these are the principles go beyond it. these eternal principles of administration, of management, of relationship. You know, everything is there. It's already established. You don't have it, other options. It may sound like it. It may seem like it. You know, like Freud, okay. Now, he bases his whole psychology on crazy people. He did not study sane people. Right? Okay, now, you take it like this. Prabhupada mentions in the Gita that if someone increases lust too much, they go crazy. So insanity is actually coming from lust. So now Freud studies all these crazy people and it comes to the conclusion that the whole world is based on lust. You know? So in other words, the underlying sexual drives of male and female is what makes the world work. Right? Now he's not coming in from the philosophical point where we're going down the level of the soul because the soul is taking on the masculine mood of enjoying. But he's not talking about that. He's just talking about day-to-day interaction. So therefore, he's only studied crazy people. He does not know what he's talking about. With crazy people, yes, he may be quite good. But with sane people, he doesn't know. But his philosophy is used on sane people. So therefore, it doesn't work. Maybe a few cases where somebody is having a problem, it works to some degree, but does it work in the long run? Somebody told Prabhupada, it says, according to Freud, then, the son, because he has affection for the mother, he wants to have sex with his mother. You know, this is the Oedipus complex. So then Prabhupada looked at that devotee and said, maybe in your country, not mine. You know, it says in your culture is, you know, maleches and yavanas, you know, animals. Maybe you think like that. It says that in our human society, you don't.
In Gandhi, what did you think? Western civilization.
Good idea.
Good idea. Yeah, it's clever. It's clever. Yeah, so the how do we get into that?
Criticism,
yeah. So the whole point is what we're saying is that unless it's authorized by scripture, it may be completely off the wall. Freud may catch a few points by observation, but that's pratyaksha. But you can't apply it now as an eternal principle. Because it won't apply. Because only Shabda can teach you what are the actual principles. And they find some nice working details. But if the situation changes, how do you apply your detail? Because you don't know the principle. Right? Like if you know a recipe, you have all the ingredients for a recipe and all the facilities for the recipe, you can cook that recipe perfectly every time. But let us say that something's missing or you don't have the particular pot or you don't have the particular... Then what do you do with those ingredients? Someone who only knows the recipe wouldn't have a clue. They're lost. Because they don't actually know the principles of cooking or of the preparation that they're dealing with. But you take someone who knows the principles, every time they cook the preparation, it may be slightly different because the situation changes every time. There's something more of this, less of this, more people, less people, or somebody doesn't like this or doesn't like that. So they make adjustments, you know, whatever they have, they do. That is expert. But just someone who has memorized the detail, that means they have a good memory, you know, they have good study habits, they have some focus to actually sit down and learn it. But because it hasn't been applied, then it won't get the result. That makes sense?
I have one question about realization. So like by studying and by applying in practical way, I don't get it. What about those situations when by some misbehavior or by mistake one loses such, you know, understanding? So is it correct to say that one, this realization is lost, or it still is there but it's
covered? No, it becomes covered.
Covered.
So unless you change your value system, then it won't be lost. It may be covered though. Mm-hmm. But by being covered for long enough, then you may accept a new value system.
And particularly I'd like to ask about this. I would say it's like, for me, it's like, the situation when we have different opinions regarding fallen gurus.
Mm-hmm.
Like, there is an opinion of Gaudiya Maharaj that actually one is fallen from his position as a guru, so it means he has not been qualified before that moment.
Well, that's if you want to establish that guru only means someone who they themselves, by their realization, is on the platform of prema, then you could say yes, he was never on the platform of prema, therefore he fell down.
Mm-hmm.
So you could say that. But otherwise, Bharat Maharaj is not in the Bhagavatam because he was a shmo. And he was an Uttamadikari and he fell down. So like it or not, then our principle is iron and fire. Because then you have to say that the jiva is internal potency, and the jiva never is, never was, and never will be. As Krishna says, there was a time when you did not exist, nor I, nor all these kings. It means the jiva has always been there, and there always will be. So they don't change. But we become absolute by being in the fire of the devotion of the internal potency. Otherwise, then we're like iron when we're in the association of the external potency. So you can have that point, but then, it's a nice point. But at the same time, as in reality, then why is it the scriptures talk about second class or third class devotees as gurus? So then you have to just take his definition of guru. He's meaning, someone who comes to the platform of Nitya Siddha, because anything below Nitya Siddha can fall down. That's that we know from scripture, that we've heard from Prabhupada. So that point is there. So the point is you can say that, but then, so he's meaning a real guru is one who's come to that platform. And we'll agree, yeah, that is the real guru. But the point is as anybody who is following in the footsteps of the real guru, if they, as it is, they're a clear, transparent via media for the instruction of that real guru, then they become as good as the real guru. They may not be the real guru, but they're as good as. Just like iron and fire is as good as fire. Or when you learn electricity through copper, copper is not electricity, it's metal. But it's as good as long as it's connected. As soon as it's not connected, you unplug the wire, there's no electricity. You take the iron out of the fire, it's not no more fire. So the point is we put in, out, like that. Does that make some sense? So that's the point. You just have to understand is what is the definitions. So that's why in this age, then they always use the founder acharya and other gurus. Because the founder, what he says is perfect for his mission. Anybody who imbibes that, takes it, practices it, gives it to others, will be successful. They don't have to speculate and make up their own. They just follow what the acharya says. Right? So in that way, then they're gurus. But only as long as they follow that direction of that founder. Then it's worth. Then they're as good as. They're the conduit, so they're as good as. So if you want to be technical, yes. It's just like bhakti. Until you come to prema, you're not a devotee. Right? Devotional service starts at prema. Like that. It's pretty close at bhava. But it's still not prema, because prema is defined as unalloyed, uninterrupted devotion. That's bhakti. Bhakti is eternal, so there never can be a point where it's not functioning. So that means the sadhaka, technically speaking, is not a devotee. Does that make sense? So, but is that the angle we take on it? Is that what we preach? Who would come forward if we made that standard? Right? So therefore, it's a point, technical point to understand so that one doesn't become proud. you know, as he advances. But at the same time, as anything in pursuance of devotion is counted as devotion. That's the verse, just, you know, in that first canto, fifth chapter, Narad Muni is explaining that. What is in connection with bhakti is counted as bhakti. So that's Bhagavatam. So that's our angle. But technically we know by tattva, yes. So technically, therefore, only a nitya siddha is guru. But anyone in pursuance of that is guru. You name me, in all the devotees in this movement, who was brought in off the street personally by Prabhupada's preaching exclusively? And who was brought in off the street by the other devotees? And I think you might find the ones who exclusively brought in by Prabhupada without the assistance of anybody else or the inspiration of anybody else is a handful. And everybody else is brought in by maybe senior, but maybe even brand new devotee who'd only joined a week before. Mm-hmm. And probably a lot were even brought in just by prasad. Brought in directly by Krishna himself. The most elevated devotees.
Okay. The prasad of bhaktis. You know what I'm saying? So that's why in these one has to be very, very careful, is that the point is well taken, but at the same time is there must be seen the art of application. Mm-hmm. Because you have rasa and you have tattva. So when you apply it, then the elements of the personal point. Because the point is those devotees advanced, and if they weren't gurus, where did it come from? You know what I'm saying? If they weren't devotees, if they weren't gurus, where did it come from? That has to be explained. So the next time you hear somebody say that, ask them then, how did these people advance? If they say, well, ask by Prabhupada's mercy, says, yes, that's the only way it works by anybody. Anyone who claims to be a guru on their own without Prabhupada's mercy is not in our line. Because that's how it works. In the Kali Yuga, gurus don't stand on their own. They stand in the line of the acharyas. You have a founder. That's the way it works. You know, the Madhvas, they all follow Madhvacharya. The Ramanuja all follow him. You know, Nimbarkas, Vishnuswami, Vallabhas, Shankarites even the Mayavadis follow this. So where are the bona fide lines that don't stand on a founder? Tell me. Buddhists, they got Buddha. Right? Jesus, they got him. Where is that line, the bona fide line? I don't see it. I haven't heard of it. So therefore, everyone after that founder is simply representing the founder anyway. So still only by the mercy of the founder. But at the same time, there is the mercy of the person who came and spent that time and energy to help you. Therefore, they're called guru.
It's also supported by Pancharatri.
Like, yeah, whoever connects you, gives you Pancharatri Diksha, then that's your guru. That's your line to do deity worship. Your authorization to do deity worship is through that person who gave you second initiation. You don't go through that person, the deity doesn't accept you in worship. You know, it's said to do that is, that's fair. It doesn't say that, you know what I'm saying? Mm-hmm. If they're bona fide practicing Brahmins who have received the mantra from their bona fide source, then you receiving that, then you have the authorization to do the worship. That's what it functions on. Within those persons that could give you that connection, you always look for the highest. But the point is for us, the highest means is who follows Srila Prabhupada nicely that we are able to relate to and understand and surrender to. That's our definition of the highest. Others may have their own definition, but that's their life, not ours. You know, like Lord Chaitanya told Sanatana Goswami. You know, when he goes to Vrindavan, he says, don't mix very closely with the Vrajavasis. They're in their own category. says, you're sadhaka, you do your thing. You know, we have our line, they have theirs. So in the same way, others can do whatever they like. We have our, offer our respects and all that, but from a distance. You know, they want to do what do we can. No problem for us. But we have our acharyas. We have our line. We have our way it works. And we follow that, Krishna will be pleased.
How is it idea of the existence has come from? How this idea of rhythmic system has come?
Rhythmic system? Means?
Yeah, I mean rhythmics.
The rhythmics.
Yeah,
it's come from the principle of frustrated temple presidents and god brothers that want to be in exclusive control and charge of their dependents, you know, to the exclusion of any gurus. Because Prabhupada's not there to come along and tell them what to do and take their devotees and move them around the temples. That's where it's gone from. It has nothing to do with philosophy, nothing to do with culture. It's simply power politics. That's all. That's all it is. As you know, notice the people who are the most strong about it are all very independent temple presidents who don't want to work under anybody's authority. Right? And they've always been like that. This is my observation. You have one or two people who have the philosophy of it, but they're also people who are independent and just don't have any respect for anybody. But the point about it is it maintains your independence, but at the same time you can be an authority. Because the temple president, he technically becomes the guru. Though he clouds it, hides it behind, no, the Prabhupada's disciples. But he's the one that tells them what Prabhupada's purports and program and everything means. So it's just that gurus come along and take disciples out of their temple, or they get, you know, affections by the disciples, or the disciples want to spend time with them or give them money, and the presidents don't like that. You know, there should be some balance, of course. There's been excesses in the past, but the point is that's where the inspiration came from. Before, in the beginning, there was no concept of this. This came after God Brothers saw that the gurus were respected, but they weren't. They want to be respected also. You know, temple presidents, they want the authority. That's where it comes from. You know, because that way it's just managerially you become guru. You don't have to have any spiritual qualification. Just by being the temple president, then you're automatically guru. It means you're guru anyway. But, you know, then you elevate yourself up to a higher platform. So that's all it is. It's just politics. It's nothing to do with philosophy or culture. If you just present it like this, no one will buy it. But you present it like it's some philosophy or culture, people will buy it, some emotion. How many times can they go with guru following? Says, well, how many girlfriends you went through? How many boyfriends you went through? And you still have faith in the system. Millions of people have tried it. No one's been satisfied in history as long as it's ever happened. But still you got married. So how many times, you know, what do you mean? How many times can you go through it? Well, give us a break. So that's the principle.
You made the point before that Prabhupada taught most austerities to study the Vedas, and you said Prabhupada, there's no way he can be criticised and offered him the best, because he took the top most and he made it available, palatable for the lowest.
Mm-hmm.
Is that just by presenting it in simple language and divesting it of all of its Sanskrit hidden tricks? Or he just was specially empowered to?
Well, empowered. It's just a matter of getting to the point. It means who you're talking to, you want to make the point get across. That's called ukta. Ukta means what is the point you're trying to make. And then language, the purpose of language is you choose words or choose a particular voice, you know, passive or active, and you use choose particular vocabulary based on your audience. Right? Because any scripture is based on a particular audience. It'll get a particular audience a particular result. That's the meaning of the particular, that's the invocation of any scripture. The invocation tells what knowledge will be given to who and what they can do with it after they've gained it. That's an invocation. So the point is you're dealing with someone who's dealing with those who are fallen into the modern scenario and how are influenced by the modern. So even those who are in the Vedic culture are still influenced by the modern. You know? So then how they will understand actually what's the essence of the Veda. Because still, even though Prabhupada presents it like that, the same sentence, the neophyte can read it, get out it, the simplest kind of like understandings of Krishna consciousness, real fundamental. And someone advanced can get out of it very deep esoteric principles. You know, and everybody in between. That's why you read the Gita today, you know, oh, I've read the Gita. But then you read it again after some time, after a couple of years, and it's kind of like, wow, you know, it's like you never read it. What's there is all new and fresh. That was the benediction of Sandipani Muni, the Krishna. And whatever's about him will be ever fresh. So that's the point is he's empowered and he knew what he was doing. He knew exactly what he wants to say and he says just that. He doesn't say more, doesn't say less. And he chooses the words for the audience. So if the audience knows all the technical terms, that's another thing, is terms that don't have a good equivalent and somebody could learn, then Prabhupada used the Sanskrit. And in some occasions he would translate that. You see many times his godbrothers would translate everything. And then you kind of lose something there. So he would have it. He uses bhakti. You know, he uses achman. He says prasadam. You know, he doesn't say sacred food. He doesn't, you know. He may say, you know, food is sanctified by, you know, offering to the Lord. So taking this prasadam then. You know, so it's like there are basic words that Sanskrit has worked in, because there aren't better terms. So whichever one explains it better, that one's used. The point is it works. But at the same time, is because he knows the whole field, therefore what works, works. Because he knows it works today, it also works tomorrow. Otherwise, sometimes devotees will cut it down and make it practical. It'll work for that situation, but then it won't work in another situation. You know, just like you're doing Sankirtan, you may develop some particular lines that work for a particular class of people at a particular time. But give it 6 months or a few years and the scenario changes, it doesn't work anymore. So then you could say, if somebody only knew lines, then after 2-3 years, then they're obsolete. And then they can't do Sankirtan. But so to understand, the principle is, I'm talking to my audience, you know, and I'm trying to get them to appreciate, you know, the importance of buying these books. You know, so therefore, then as the chimes and people change, then they change their how they present it. But the point stays the same. The book still went into their hand. You know what I'm saying? So the purports are there, and they explain it, and those purports will be valuable for the next 10,000 years. The Prabhupada says there'll be purports on those purports. So that means with time, then devotees will understand deeper things from Prabhupada's purports, so then they'll write on those. You know? Does that make some sense? So then it will go deeper, because so much is there. The words that Prabhupada chooses, those aren't arbitrary words. Simple language, not much language, but those words, you don't need much. Those words itself get it done.
That's an area of philosophical siddhanta. Some people would say now that if Prabhupada was still here, he would have adjusted
Yeah, he would have forbade the devotees from using email. That's what he would have done. We're here to change the society, not be molded and made into slaves by it. That's not, you know, becoming, you know, fitting in. Fitting in means being a slave, a shudra to the system. Shudras fit in. Bus. Brahmins, Kshatriyas, and Vaishyas lead it. Shudras, they fit in. You know, and I say that boldly. Anyone in history, whoever did anything that we still talk about, didn't follow the norm. They set the norm. So the whole point is we're talking about fitting in. The Buddhists, they're the ones that are the authorities on karma and reincarnation, not us. We know more about it than them. But why we're not? Because we're busy fitting in like shooters. And the Buddhists are perfectly happy to be Buddhists with their bald heads and their funny orange or purple robes. Right? And people accept them for what they are, how they are, how they look, because they're not trying to fit in. They're trying to fit everyone else into Buddhism. And we're trying to be fit into the karmic culture of shudra consumerism. So that's why we're not the authorities in these fields. Otherwise, there's no one that can answer the questions that we can answer. But that means the devotee should be studying Prabhupada's books rather than all these other outside books trying to solve ISKCON's, you know, problems by material solutions. There are no material solutions to material problems, let alone material solutions to spiritual problems. You know? Like that. So it's unfortunate. And people say, no, but practical. Practical what? What practically is done? How has the respect for authority in ISKCON developed by using these modern techniques? None. Day by day, the GBC becomes less and less respectable. Right? And in, you know, specific areas or zones or temples or communities where there is respect for authorities, because they use the traditional methods taught by Prabhupada. There's respect for the guru and respect for the, you know, senior Vaishnavas and that, and you don't deal like this, criticize and sit around and tell everybody what's on your mind. And, you know, you don't use these kind of techniques. And so, and it flourishes. It's opulent, it's prosperous, the devotees are enlivened, they're advancing. It's happening. And these other ones that don't, day by day, getting less and less and less and less. Because the point is, Krishna makes this system, not us. You know, and he authorizes his devotee, Prabhupada, to give that to us. And we follow it, we it works. We don't follow it, it doesn't work. It's that simple. Yeah. So, there's no need to speculate. There's need to apply the intelligence how to get it done for time, place, and circumstance, yes. But not by compromising our principles. They say when Prabhupada was here, he'd do it different. But look at this. 1960s. Beards, long hair, dope, and sex, and mental speculation. This was a vowed, accepted culture. Prabhupada, you know, and non-violence. Prabhupada went in through the Bhagavad Gita, which is a battlefield. He got all these hippies to shave their head and beard, give up sex, give up dope. And then we're going to say, well, if Prabhupada was here, he'd do it differently. You know, I don't believe it. I don't think the people that say that know who Prabhupada is. When Prabhupada was here, the women weren't complaining that they were second-class citizens. And Prabhupada said all these things about women right in front of them. They felt sheltered, protected. They know it's right. Any self-respecting, intelligent woman knows they're all right. They only deny them to, you know, pull the wool over the men's eyes so that they could get control. You know, because they don't trust men will take care of them. They have trust and men will take care of them. What do they care? But if they think men won't take care, then they shouldn't know either, because then that'll be a weakness by which they can't, you know, establish their authority. So all these different things. It's just like modernity. The problem is modern man is so proud of his modernness that he thinks it's something special and unique. Modernity, simply, its Vedic definition is non-Vedic. It doesn't follow the scriptures. That's modern. There's always been modern people. Millions of years ago, there were modern people. You know? So, that's it. Modern man's always been there. You know, that's the thing in the archaeological field. At the same time Neanderthal man was there, modern man was also there. I mean, you see people today, they look like Neanderthal. You know? I've seen people. Exactly the same cheekbones and everything. You know?
Missing
wing. Huh?
Missing wing.
Yeah, so that's the point, is that there's tons of them. Sometimes there's even whole countries full of them. You know? So it's like, you know, that's the whole thing, is that the mode of devotional service and the mode of ignorance is symptoms are that one is proud of one's previous abilities and knowledge and education and background. And so therefore, that bleeds through into his devotional life.
Well, Bob Nunn is always saying that our main problem is we think that the Western culture, civilization, has something to offer.
Yeah. What has it got to offer? It's got a few gizmos and gadgets. Okay, so what? Use them. Is anybody saying don't use your cell phone or don't use your computer? Don't use your car? No one's saying. But you have your calculator, and you take an abacus, and the guy with the abacus will be quicker than the guy with the calculator. And they've had abacuses for thousands and thousands of years. So it's not like these gizmos and gadgets haven't been there. So what? You got your mobile phone. Okay, use it. Big deal. But you don't need the culture of it. You don't have to have the look on your face like the guy in the commercial when he talks on his phone. You know? So what has that got to do with it? You said Western culture. Western culture. What do they have to offer? Yes, I want to know. What is it? Name it. Their educational system? Their clothes? Right? The way they live in their house? Taking bath once a week? Their food? What is it that they have to offer? You know, the language. What is there, if you really realistically look at it, what is there to offer? And even if you say they're closed, but then after 6 months it's changed. Right? Their food. You name me the culture that's got some decent food. Right? Okay, we take English food. What's English food? Boiled carrots? Piece of meat? I mean, it's just like, you know, it's like when it comes to cooking, they don't know what they're doing. You know, so anything exotic in Western has come from the East. Right? You go back hundreds of years when the spice trade was going on, spices were worth more than gold. Where'd those spices come from? India. Right? Why are the indigenous people of North and South America called Indians? Because they were looking for a passageway to India. Because it was economically the biggest thing was to get stuff from India and sell it in Europe. So anything that made anything exotic and fine in the way of food, that it came from India. It's just they're not reading their history to say that there's anything from modern culture. So even if there is some interest, they got a salad or they got a thing. Yogurt, where'd yogurt come from? Right? India has it. And then I think the Swedes had it. It became popular in the 60s as some weird exotic thing that the Swedes were into. You know, or your granola or muesli, that's also their food. Right? It's not American, it's not British, it's not French, it's not German. You know? You know what I'm saying? So, therefore, it's coming from a few different places. Your spaghetti comes from China. Right? I mean, that's how the story goes. Marco Polo, I was so impressed by it, he brought it back, and then they started making noodles.
I can think of Western cultures like material efficiency. They can build roads.
Yeah, but Indians, and then you look at that when Indians go over to the West, who does it better? So it's not Western culture. It's just that because they're so dedicated to materialism, they think they can make the material world perfect. Well, the Indians are stuck in between, thinking that only by spiritualness you can perfect it, so therefore performing our duties perfectly, then we'll go back to Godhead, where you had an efficient culture, to the point where they don't perform their duties, and then they're stuck in between. So that's okay, but you want to see a good road, the best road I ever saw is between Bangalore and Udupi. That thing's made out of granite. It's a perfect road. So Indians can build it. They can build anything. The whole computer industry is moving to India. Because it's much cheaper to maintain the Indians. Indians are 60% of the computer software and hardware thing in America. 60% are Indians. You know? That's Indians. And then you probably have Chinese and this and that. So very few are whiteies. Whiteies don't have that much to offer. I mean, you look at it. You had a flourishing culture in in South America. You had their own kind of tribal cultures in North America. You know, the Chinese had their culture. The Japanese had their culture. Philippines, India, Middle East. They all had flourishing cultures. Family units that worked, you know, economics. They had their own cuisine and all that. And the white men go in there and just totally destroy it. There's not an instance that they didn't go in and didn't destroy the local culture. And they didn't replace it with anything of great standing. And then they claim that, you know, they're savages. Right? But that's what happened. You look at it. Up to the, you know, 1600s, 1700s, there were flourishing cultures all over the world. But somehow or another, because of their, you know, being the descendants of the, you know, Kshatriyas that fled India, they had that warring spirit and they're clever. Then they took over. You know? So you tell me, how is television something so great? How is the internet so great? Video games. You know?
The
point is the roads are great, the cars are great, because you have to go hours to get somewhere. Before, you used to work in your own house or in your own village.
You're saying the solutions, they solve one aspect of the problem, but they don't deal with the
other. Yeah, they just destroy another. Yeah, you have to travel 2 hours a day to and from your work. Then what does that do to your family life? That's 2 hours less with your family. You know? And, you know, it's modern living, fancy, you have all these, they have a washing machine, they have this and that, but the wife has to work, therefore she needs those. Right? And she only has to work because she has them. And that's the whole point.
You know, what you're saying, that we're not supposed to fit in, that we're supposed to separate things.
Probably said cultural revolution. So that's the whole point, is we're afraid of our own culture. We're afraid of our own culture. You can see it. How many devotees who are in communication ever do their communication work in dhotis? And even if they do wear outside clothes, do they ever go as gentlemen? Some may. They go in their three-piece suit, or the women go in some really high-class, you know, culture deserved dress. No, they all go out flouncy, you know, just like girls and boys on the street. One or two may be a little bit more. I say Mukunda Maharshi, I think he's very careful about how he dresses. You know? So that's the point, is it's they're always making excuses for our culture. You know, it's kind of like they go, well, you have a caste system, you know, like that. You know, well, you know, that's a thing. It's obsolete. Lord Chaitanya got rid of it, and this and that, and you know, like that. And, you know, ah, you got, you know, you burn the ladies when the husband dies. And, well, you know, that was something, that's some archaic thing, that, you know, so. Why not? It says, caste system means it's by birth. But the point is society is divided into four anyway. You have your intellectuals, you have administrators, you have your business class, and you have your labor class. It says you can't get around it. No culture of the world gets around it. It says you name the culture. Where is the culture? You fit into one of these four. Right? So therefore, what are you talking about? You know? But the point is, this caste system means it's by birth. You're automatically an intellectual, automatically. No, you have to be by qualification. Just like, you know, oh, you got doctors. Yes, it says, but they're doctors by qualification. You know? So that's like saying a doctor and a quack. Quack means he doesn't have qualification, but he's claiming to be a doctor. Doctor means he has qualification. That's the difference between Varnashram and the caste system. Then the people go, oh, okay. You know, it's a scientific way to organize society. It's just like you have one guy trying to do everything. He's called the jack of all trades, master of none. So the Vedic system is everyone specializes. You're an intellectual, then you fully be an intellectual. You're an administrator, you fully be an administrator. You're a business person, you fully do business. You assist others, you fully get into it. Then economics is at its best, management's at its best, knowledge is at its best. You know, art is at its best. You know? And then everybody's individuals can do any of the things of the other. They may study some, or they have to manage their own life, or they get into some art, this hobby, you know, so everyone has that. But it's only consideration of economics. Right? Like that. And ashram, that's a matter of spiritual. It says you can't study nicely if you're hanging around girls and boys all the time. Like that. The karmis know it doesn't work. Devotees will say, you know, the boys are around the girls and they're less affected by the girls, and that's theirs because they don't know what unaffected men look like. So they don't know. They don't know how to recognize. So, like that. That's the whole point. So what does it have to offer? We use it, we may function with it, but that doesn't mean it itself has anything to offer. You know? That's the whole point. You know, a few gadgets and gizmos work nicely. Okay, great. Fabulous. But does the social system work? No. Do the family units work? No. And if they do work, why do they work? Because of religion, not because of, you know, modernness. So that's the whole. Is that as long as that faith is there, then you have faith in something that's atheist. Okay, I think we should end. So, yeah.
Srila Prabhupada ki,
Samavita Bhaktivinoda ki, Chinese I don't defend.